This is a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Hello, are you there? Is your brain switched on?
Good, let's do it. Another episode of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. This is the only show that takes you to the most deadly part of the galaxy and then gets you back in around half an hour. My name's Dan. Thank you so much for giving us a download and a play. This week, we're learning about how chickens might soon cure cancer. Also, we'll take a trip to the South Pole and we'll talk about one of the most deadly viruses in history. Not just in history, around right now. It still exists. We'll find out loads more about it with this week's Dangerous Dan. Also, I'll do some shout-outs in just a sec. First, let's catch up with one of our favourite geniuses here at Fun Kids HQ. It's Professor Hallux, and this week he's looking deep down inside your body.
Professor Hallux's kaleidoscopic antibiotic. I think I need a replacement body. Mine's rubbish.
Oh, come on, that's not true. Your body is doing a great job of protecting you from infections.
Doesn't feel like it. Go on, do us a favour and take a look inside me, would you, Nanobot?
Oh, all right. I'll charge up the heli-telly bubble and get down to the size of an atom to investigate. Back in a jiffy.
Heli-telly bubble, ready to launch in 3, 2, 1.
Gosh. It's getting hot as we approach the Professor's skin. He's got quite a fever.
Welcome to the immune system in action. Microbes like being at the body's normal temperature, 37 degrees Celsius. They don't like it when the body raises the temperature to help fight off infections. That's what happens when you have a fever.
Even at this size, it's very difficult to get inside a human body. Skin is designed to be a tough, waterproof barrier that keeps foreign things out. That's why if you have a cut or a graze, it's a good idea to wash and cover up so that infections can't sneak in. Let's try somewhere different. Setting coordinates for the ear.
Oh, it tickles. Careful as you go. Don't bonk me on the stirrup.
Even where there are holes, like your ears and nose, you'll find substances like mucus, earwax and hairs, all designed to trap particles and viruses. And the Professor certainly has got hairy ears. Hold on.
In 4 micrometres, fare right on the eustachian tube and merge with the throat.
Travelling down the Professor's lungs now. Left a bit. He's got a chest infection by the look of it. I can see Streptococcus pneumoniae bacteria. There's certainly a lot of them around, gathering in pairs. No wonder he's feeling so grotty.
White blood cells have been detected. The body's immune system has been activated.
As you may know, there's more to blood than just, well, blood. As well as red blood cells that carry oxygen to all parts of the body, platelets and other substances suspended in a fluid called plasma, blood also contains white blood cells that help the body fight infections. Look, here comes a lymphocyte. That's a type of white blood cell coming to the rescue.
Some lymphocytes produce special proteins called antibodies, which attach to the surface of the harmful microbe, like a key in a lock, helping to destroy them. Different lymphocytes have different keys, so sometimes it takes a while for the human body to find the right match. But when it is found, the microbes are in trouble. Sometimes antibodies will cause the harmful microbes to burst open to prevent them from reproducing.
What's going on in there, Nanobot?
If I'm right, this lymphocyte is using its antibodies to alert the phagocytes. They're a different type of white blood cell. Yup, here they come. They're chasing the bacteria and are eating it. Incredible! Although I don't want them to think I'm a harmful bacteria. Time to go. I think we're being followed.
The clever thing about the immune system is that once white blood cells have successfully defeated a bacteria, other cells, called memory cells, remain in their body. This way, if the same microbe appears again, the body has its defences ready.
I do believe I'm feeling a little better, Nanobot. Thanks for giving me a checkup.
Don't thank me. Thank those hard-working white blood cells and all your other body's defences.
Professor Hallux's Kaleidoscopic Antibiotic, with support from eBug and Public Health England. Find out more at funkidslive.com/Hallux or visit e-bug.eu.
Now remember, if you've got a science question niggling around your brain that you want answered on this show, you need to let me know as a review over on the Apple Podcast Store. That's what William from Birmingham has done. William, hello William, who asks, why does lightning fly down from the sky in clouds and how does it form? Actually, William, this is an incredibly complex answer because lightning doesn't always fly down. Quite often it flies up from the ground to the clouds, and it will also fly between clouds. It's all to do with electrical charges, William. Right, imagine a cloud, you know, big, big, massive gas and stuff that's in the air. And there's all these particles inside. And when things get stormy and turbulent up in the sky, all those particles, they'll knock together, like the ice, and everything will rub against each other. And this will create an electrical charge in the cloud. Now the positively charged particles will rise to the top of the cloud, whereas the negatively charged particles, they will sink to the bottom. And then the lightning happens. It's kind of like a spark that you might see around your house between electrics every day. Maybe if you're on a train, you'll see it flying as the wheel rattles along the tracks underneath you. The negative charges at the bottom of the cloud are attracted to all the positive electrical charges in particles that are across the world, you know, in things like trees and in massive metal poles, and the electricity will jump between them, because that's just naturally how the world works. Did you know that lightning, it's around 27,000 degrees Celsius, which is 6 times hotter than the surface of the sun? So there you go. William, thank you so much for the question. I hope I did it justice. It's quite a complex answer to give in one show. If I'm being honest, we could dedicate a whole series to this, but still, brilliant question. I love trying to figure out why the everyday things around us happen. William, that's amazing. If you've got a question that you want answered by a proper expert on this show, you need to let me know. Leave it as a review over on the Apple Podcast Store. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Today we are headed to Australia to hear the question from Charlie. He's left it as a review on the Apple Podcast Store. He wants to know, will apes or chimpanzees become humans like us? And from Australia, we're headed to Dorset in the south of the UK to chat to Dr. Alison Cronin of Monkey World. Alison, thank you so much for coming on.
Hi, Dan, and hello, Charlie.
So let's kind of start with the obvious then. I guess, as far as you can tell us, what is the difference between humans and apes and chimpanzees? And also, what's the difference between apes, chimpanzees, and other monkeys, as far as you can tell?
You have actually sort of three different groups of primates that exist on the planet. You have prosimians, which generally comprise the lorises and the lemurs that come from the lemurs coming from Madagascar. And then you have the group of animals called monkeys, which is, you know, everybody loves monkeys. And then you have the apes, which are both great apes and lesser apes. So within that ape grouping, you've got chimpanzees, gorillas, two different species of orangutan, Bornean orangutan, Sumatran orangutan, and human beings. Humans are great apes and are therefore very closely related, most closely related actually, to chimpanzees. Now, within that ape grouping, there are also the lesser apes, which are all of the gibbons.
So as far as, you're probably the most qualified person to tell me about this thing, you know, because you study monkeys, you work with them every day, and also you're a human, you have human friends. As far as you can tell, what are the similarities between us humans and apes. How are we alike the most?
Okay, well, there are a whole lot of people out there in the world who specialize specifically in studying these kinds of things. So you have paleoanthropologists who actually study the fossil record. So I don't know if all of you remember hearing about Lucy, the fossil hominid that they found in Tanzania that was meant to be the first real human being. And that was Louis Leakey who dug up the fossil remains of Lucy. But from paleoanthropology, you have primatologists that then study existing primate species. So, you know, I have a bit of a background in both in terms of my university training, but now I simply work at Monkey World rescuing primates that have been smuggled from the wild or have suffered abuse and neglect. And here at the park, we actually have 22 different species of both prosimians, monkeys, and great apes. So we have both chimpanzees here at the park and Bornean and Sumatran orangutans. And then, of course, plus all of us human beings. So, yeah, and the similarities that you generally observe between primate species, and now I'm including all primate species, so all of those monkeys, whether it's the smallest little marmoset, capuchin monkeys, through to the chimpanzees, is that most of them, most all of them, are family living animals. So they rely upon each other. All of them have emotions just like human beings. So they suffer fear, loss, grief, happiness, sorrow, jubilation, you know, all of those different emotions that humans feel, primates feel as well. And when you start looking at the species that were more closely related, that humans are more closely related to, such as the chimpanzee, then you start seeing very obvious and distinct anatomical similarity. So we look, our bodies are sort of set up in a very similar way, and our skeleton anatomy is very similar to that of a chimpanzee that's sort of basically just shorter and stockier and designed to be a whole lot stronger. The biggest hallmark for becoming a human being is walking upright. So in the fossil record, the first fossils found that people started traditionally referring to as hominid were those fossils like Australopithecus afarensis. It's a great name. But that was the first fossil human, if you will, that they believe walked purely upright on their hind legs.
From what you see, Alison, with the 22 different species that you've got down at Monkey World, behaviorally, how are the species and the primates that you've got there different? How do they act differently? What do they do every day in their life, in their routine, that makes them some unique, some maybe strange, some weird, and some glorious?
Yeah, that's a great question, Dan. And primates do fill all of those characteristics that you just mentioned. And really the key factor on all of that, once again, relates back to Charlie's question, and it's all about evolution. All of the different species have evolved to live in different habitats in the tropical forest. And a few species have actually sort of taken up living in parts of the world that aren't even tropical anymore, like the Japanese snow monkeys or macaques that live up in, you know, snow-covered mountains in Japan and use the hot water, the natural hot water springs to keep warm during the winter months and so on. But here at the park, we have the full range from, you know, nocturnal loris that are very different because they're prosimians, so the forerunners, if you will, to the monkeys and the apes. And both the lorises and the lemurs, which we also have at Monkey World, have a wet nose. So in terms of their evolution, you can see that they look more, that they haven't evolved as close to a human being, say, as a chimpanzee. Their eyes are adapted for the lorises for a nocturnal world. So they have big, huge eyes that relate to catching every little bit of light so that they can see at nighttime. Both the lorises and the lemurs have a wet nose, so they're relying on their sense of smell a whole lot more than humans and the great apes, who have evolved binocular vision, so forward-facing eyes, so that you have really good depth perception and can, you know, make accurate leaps from branch to branch and be able to catch and hunt insects and any other animal prey. So you've got the full range of both body size, animals adapting to different types of habitat, from, you know, gibbons who swing with their long arms underneath branches. They're able to eat the fruits that grow and ripen that hang underneath the branches that, say, the orangutans that they share the same forest with. The orangutans can't get out underneath those long branches that where the fruit hangs down, otherwise the branches would break underneath them because they're so big-bodied. So different species have evolved to fill different ecological niches in the wild so that they can all live in different parts of the forest and have good and full lifestyles within their little ecological niche. And that's what drives and pushes evolution. So, you know, whether it's a chimpanzee that has evolved into a multi-male group-living animal that's territorial, defending its territory from other rival groups and hunting down monkeys and, you know, other animal prey to feed the group, to, you know, the tiniest of marmosets who have specialized in the South American forests to eat sap and gum that they scratch the bark of trees and then lick up the sap and gum that comes out. So these are very specialist adaptations to living very different lifestyles, and you can see that in the full range of primates that exist today on the planet.
Alison, thank you so much. Monkey World open all year apart from Christmas Day. Must be very snowy there at the moment. How are things very quickly?
Yeah, today it's very cold, so we still let everybody go outside. There's a fair amount of snow on the ground here in Dorset today, but our buildings are sort of gymnasium size for the chimpanzees, and they are centrally heated, so they have the choice to go outside and play in the snow. And you know what? They do come running out and make snowballs, chuck them around. Some of them sit there and eat them, and then when they get cold, they go back inside. But everybody just needs to remember we need to have respect for the planet and respect for all of the different species that we share our planet with. And this includes all of the diversity of primates. We need to protect their habitats, because Monkey World's being called around the globe now to rescue monkeys and apes that are being smuggled from the wild for the black market pet trade. But also they're suffering terribly as their habitats are being destroyed through, you know, palm oil plantations and basically humans sort of taking over the habitat that so many of these primate species come from.
Alison, well said, and carry on just the fantastic word. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming on the Fun Kids Science Weekly.
Thanks, Dan.
Right, it's time for this week's Dangerous Dan, where we look at some of the most mean and evil things in the universe. And this time, we're looking at one of the worst viruses around. Dengue first appeared in the 1950s in Asia, around the Philippines and in Thailand, and since then it has spread all around the world. Almost half of the planet lives in areas where the virus is endemic, and the worst part is that's only going to get worse. Now, dengue is carried by mosquitoes, who bite most often in the morning and then in the early evening, and they hang around in stagnant, manky, murky water, and you'll get a fever if you catch dengue virus from this mosquito, because as it sucks your blood, it pushes viruses and infections and disgusting bacteria into you. And with dengue, you'll get a fever, you'll get an awful headache, you'll be sick, you'll be covered in a rash, you won't be able to eat, your muscles will ache all over. Now, it won't kill you, but still, it's drastically dangerous. Currently, you find it in Asia, in the Caribbean, in South America, in Africa, in Australia. But as the world gets hotter, what with global warming and everything, the spread of dengue fever, it's only going to grow. We'll take a trip to the South Pole in a sec. Also, we'll find out why chickens might help cure cancer. That's on the way after we look to the sky and find out more about the weather all around us with our climate guru.
Marina Ventura's Climate Explorers.
Hi there, Marina Ventura here. I love finding out about the natural world, and that includes the Earth's climate. We know that weather can change from one day to the next, but climates can change too, over the time span of years, centuries, or even longer. So I'm on a mission to fill MapApp with the latest climate information with the help of some awesome climate explorers. Come on then, let's go. We are lucky that most of us live in comfortable homes and have enough to eat. Just imagine if we didn't. What would we do? Maybe we'd move somewhere else, if we could. But what if we couldn't? Now, other than our pampered pets, animals don't live in houses, but they do have habitats. Places that are safe and comfortable for them to live in, with enough sources of food to keep them going. As climates change, these habitats can change too. Isn't that right, Maffy?
It certainly is. Animals and plant life are affected by climate change just as much as humans can be. And whilst most species can cope and adapt with gradual changes, rapid changes and the loss of natural habitats can create challenges for wildlife.
Let's find out more from someone who studies a very interesting animal in a very beautiful place.
Hi, I'm Rose, and I'm a conservation scientist. I study animals and the food they eat, and that's something that can change as the climate changes. Changing climates can affect wildlife in lots of ways. Some animals, like frogs and newts, are very sensitive to temperature and may die if their homes become much warmer or colder. A changing climate may affect the vegetation that grows, and this might mean that there isn't enough for the animals to eat, or may mean that animals can't safely nest or build homes. Sometimes the animals might be able to migrate or move to a new habitat, but if not, animals can be short of food and may die out. I work on tropical islands and study the Aldabra giant tortoise, carefully looking at what they eat, so we can understand what we call food webs. What's eating what, or who's eating who?
But there must be a lot of tortoises to study. How on earth do you figure out what they've had for dinner?
It's the poo that tells us what the tortoises had to eat. We look at the plant DNA found in the poo, and this tells us exactly which plants the tortoises have been eating. Food webs can give us information about the effect of climate change on animal populations and how they are changing too.
So, how has the change in climate affected the tortoises?
Well, the island where these tortoises came from originally is called the Aldabra Atoll. It's a place in the Indian Ocean that's at risk of being submerged because of rising sea levels. If this happens, these tortoises could die out. Luckily, some tortoises have been moved by scientists to other islands in the Indian Ocean where different types of tortoises have already become extinct. We're looking at what the tortoises eat in their new homes to see how their presence affects the food web.
Lucky tortoises having you on their side. Thanks, Rose. We share the world with millions of varieties of plants and animals, and all of them are affected by changes in the climate. And we might not think they affect us, but don't forget, humans are part of a food web too.
All this talk of food is making me hungry for an upload.
Ready, Mappy?
Load me up.
Next time, we'll be looking at what you can do to help reduce the impact we have on our environment.
Marina Ventura's Climate Explorers, supported by the Natural Environment Research Council. The science of the natural world. Find out more at funkidslive.com/marina.
Let's have a look at the science that has been in your news this week. The US icebreaker Nathaniel B. Palmer has left Chile and it's on the way to the Thwaites Glacier. This is the huge ice stream in Antarctica. We've spoken about this quite a lot on the show before. We've had a proper scientist that's been to the Thwaites Glacier. We've had her on and they're going there now. They're looking at why the ice is melting. And so scientists are headed to Thwaites because they want to understand its future effect on sea rise from this gigantic iceberg. And they think that if it all melts, it will add 80 centimeters centimetres to the height of the world's oceans. Also, researchers have genetically modified chickens that lay eggs, which can help cure arthritis and even some cancers. The medicines that use in that are used in the eggs is 100 times cheaper to produce when laid by a chicken than when they're made in factories. And as far as the chicken knows, it's just a normal egg. But this genetic modification, it can help those who are sick. But is it right to genetically modify animals? That's for other people to discuss, I think. And finally, the periodic table is 150 years old. This is the chart that you might have seen in your school. You know, it shows all the elements that we found in the world. There are 118 of them, from hydrogen to helium, from beryllium to californium. And it's having a big birthday, 150 years old, this year. Thank you so much. That is it for this week's Fun Kids Science Weekly. If you've enjoyed any of the series, Professor Alex Marina Ventura, that you've heard on the show, we've got tons more of them covering all sorts of different subjects in science, from what happens inside your body to also the germs that are around you, and also in loads, we travel back through time. You can find them all right now over on Apple Podcasts, they're on Spotify, on the free Fun Kids app, and over at funkidslive.com. And Fun Kids, we're a kids radio station from the UK. You can get us all over the country on your DAB digital radio, on that free Fun Kids app. And as always, we're at funkidslive.com.
So that was a podcast from the children's radio station, Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.